money that I would go out every single weekend to go bars, hang out, grab some beers, have a good time, right? Never ever an issue. But the second I asked them to start working on a business, like, hey, once a week, let's meet for an hour, right? Not like 4 or 5 hours like we do, we're gonna do absolutely nothing. Let's meet for 1 hour, but let's get 1 hour of work in, and then over time, we'll have this thing done. And then it's like, all of a sudden, his time's valuable, and he doesn't have time to spend and all, you know? Because it's not just the, it's not just time, it's the investment of work, right? So people don't want to invest the work until they know for sure that they're going to get a financial return, which, as we just talked about, you can't be focused on the financial return out the gate, but if you just focus on doing the pro work, the financial return will come. So feel me when I bring it, sing it loud.
I'm from the loop and I'm proud, run a mile for the cause. I'm right. Hi guys, it's your girl Nechama, your favorite Jew from the loo. Welcome back to my podcast. And today I am so excited to have Jeremy Jenin. Welcome. I love it. We're drinking my coffee right now because Jeremy forced me because I'm really tired. So it just makes sense. We're going through a heat wave right now. We should have something cold.
Right.
Yeah.
Heat wave.
So Jeremy and I met a month ago, mm-hmm. and a half ago, something yep. like that. It was prior to my Africa trip.
Prior mountain climbing trip.
Right. And we met at an event that I was not supposed to even be at. And I don't think I was part of the initial invites, actually, but it's okay.
So I think a lot of people go to those to talk to a bunch. And I talked to 4 or 5.
So I changed my perspective on social events and networking events, where a lot of times I used to feel a lot of anxiety, which I think a lot of people can relate to. But what happened is I started studying Kabbalah, which we did not talk about at all, by the way.
Okay.
Which is all about spirituality and whatnot.
What is it?
Kabbalah.
Yeah, Kabbalah, the sporting goods store.
Kabbalah, spirituality, which basically talks about this concept. It's not a religion. It's just a spirituality thing where it's God, universe, source, whatever speaks to you, wants mm-hmm. to give you all the desires of your soul. That's going to crack me up the entire time. But the only thing standing between you and everything that you want is your own limiting beliefs, which I really liked. It's way more in depth. It goes way more into it. But one of the things he talked about is everything's energy, right?
Yeah.
So if you're going to one of these big social events and you are in the mindset of what are people thinking of me? I feel so uncomfortable. I feel so awkward. You're first of all, you're in this energy where you're trying to take from others, right? Because you're what am I getting out of this?
Right.
And then also just everyone could feel this energy that you're giving off is not warm.
It's not yourself.
Right. Versus if you go and you're well, how can I serve others? Right. I want to listen. I want to observe. Let me be a space where if I'm comfortable, others will naturally be drawn to talk to me anyways.
Right. And then you start listening to someone and you're oh wow, I should not have listened. I shouldn't have started listening to this person. And then you got to find someone else. Quick.
Or if you are me, you decide to start a podcast based on that. In case the mic can't pick it up, for some reason his straw is making a whistling sound every time and it's cracking me.
I didn't even notice.
Yeah. Anyways, so I thought that was really interesting. How why shouldn't you just take something that naturally people are, if they're going to open up and talk to you, turn it into something that eventually you can monetize?
I guess so. Yeah. And here we are.
And here we are.
Boom, making the big bucks. Got me on here.
Yeah, that's right. So tell everyone a little bit about you and what you do.
My name is Jeremy Jenin. I'm a piano player and comedian and singer in St. Louis. I currently play at local galas. I've got a few agents that book me here that I work with regularly. And that's it. That's pretty much what I'm doing right now is music and comedy and social media.
I love how you breezed over the comedy part, but you were so passionate about the music part.
It's intertwined.
Right.
So it's the same thing. So whatever, even if I'm talking about one, I'm talking about both.
Okay.
So I do music and comedy shows. So I do them separately, but also my favorite is to do them together. So usually when I'm talking about music and comedy stuff, talking about either one independently, I'm talking about both.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the very beginning with music. Okay, because one of the things that I love the most about your music journey is that I feel most times when you hear about musicians, it's usually something that someone started when they were early childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't start learning how to play piano, you told me, till like your early 30s.
Right.
And you're still in your early 30s. So.
I got a job as a bouncer at a piano bar. So I taught kickboxing classes. Mm-hmm. And a couple of my students were kickboxing, or they were bouncers at this local piano bar. And at the time, I don't think I had, maybe I had been in there a couple of times. But anyways, they said, hey, we needed extra help at the piano bar. So I filled in for a weekend. They asked me to come back the next weekend. And then they offered me like a full-time bouncing position, or, you know, full-time for bouncing, which is like every weekend.
Right.
And then from that, so I bounced there for a while. And one of the piano players, he was there with a girl, and some big guy came up to this piano player and kind of, I guess, I don't think he intentionally intimidated him, but he started talking to this gal, you know, like, I guess, trying to hit on her or whatever. And so the guy just rolled in the back and, like, hit him, you know, basically. And so the guy got a lot of flack from doing that for the bouncers. And so, like, you know, a few weeks go by, and I went up to him, and I said, hey, man, I said, you ever thought about taking kickboxing lessons? And he's like, oh man, that'd be pretty cool. I'd be interested in that. And I was like, well, I'm interested in piano lessons. And if you're serious, like, we can train. You teach me piano and I'll teach you kickboxing.
Yeah. But just pausing for a moment, was it about the piano? I mean, obviously you were in that environment,
mm-hmm.
but what was it that made you decide, yeah, this is something I want to pursue?
The piano bar I was at, it had a comedy club next to it. Okay. And I was already, as an amateur, just learning comedy and, like, studying in depth. Money as, like, a sales guy or something, just being able to make people laugh. But I never thought of it like I would be necessarily an entertainer. I just thought of it as, like, a business exercise to learn comedy.
Okay, yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Because if the best way to make, like, a sale is to have an authentic, genuine connection with someone.
Sure. And if you're funny, it just helps connect with some people.
Yeah, for sure.
So I went next door and I talked to this comedian and I said, hey, man, how long have you been doing comedy? He told me like 8 years. And then I said, do you mind me asking what you make per weekend? And he said like $350. So I was like, well, how much do you have to work? And he said, man, I have to work Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, every night. And so, you know, that's calculating all this in my head. That's 175 divided by 2. That's what? 80, shoot. What is that? 8750, I think. Whatever it is. So I was thinking, that's what you're getting paid per night. I was like, man, you can make more than that as a server, right?
Right.
And so then I went, I'm looking at these guys next door playing piano, singing, doing comedy on stage. And so I was like, man, I wonder what they're making. So I asked that guy, and he said it was closer to like about $1,700 a weekend.
Wow, that's a big difference.
All right. So I thought, and I asked, so I grabbed him at the piano and said, hey, man, how long does it take you to learn this? And he said, man, if you just, you know, if I started at zero, like, how long would it take? He said, probably like 8 years. And so I was like, all right, this guy's doing it 8 years. This, if I did this for 8 years, I could maybe do it, you know. So I just decided that moment to just start playing, like, taking piano seriously and going for it.
Yeah.
It was just a matter of I saw an opportunity where I was around a bunch of piano players. I saw an opportunity that I could step up to the plate and put work in and get something crazy to happen.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because this totally aligns with this common theme that I feel like I've had with a lot of guests, especially like in the entrepreneur world or anyone who's just like following a career that they're super passionate about as well, which is it's just following your curiosity. It's asking those questions and then making logical decisions for you, what makes sense based on what you find out, instead of doing maybe just like the status quo or the safe jobs.
Well, but I think also I had a safe job like the whole time I was doing, you know, pursuing this.
Well, yeah.
So I definitely agree. Yeah. But I worked. I never quit my day job. I didn't, you know.
You didn't just dive in.
I mean, I dove in work-wise. I didn't dive in by quitting my job.
Right. So what were you doing with your 9-to-5, if you will?
At that exact moment, I was doing construction. So daytime, I was a carpenter building houses. I was competing in sports in the evenings. And then on the weekends, I'd, you know, bounce or something.
Right. So that makes sense. I mean, also, the type of job that being, like, a comedian or doing music anyways, it's going to be in the evenings and weekends. So it really wouldn't be a conflict with having a 9-to-5 in the beginning.
Right.
Yeah. So then are you currently at a point that you can focus fully on that?
I am, but I wouldn't.
Okay. Why?
Why wouldn't I? Because there's so many other opportunities that arise that, like, if you just focus on this one thing and you're tunnel visioned, you'll miss out on a lot of other stuff.
Okay.
So just like, for example, social media wise, I work with multiple sports organizations. I train, or I do videos with world-class athletes, with UFC fighters, with pro fighters all over the country, with world-class coaches. And so, like, if I wasn't doing that little bit, like this one small thing, which is just shooting videos and shooting photos for different companies, I'd miss out on all that. Like, if I was just doing the piano side.
Right.
So, like, that's, you know, just for one example. I think that, and then, you know, also back to it, if I was just a musician, I wouldn't be at the level I am now, because I've leveraged my social media skills to grow my music and comedy business.
Okay, yeah.
So if I wasn't focused on multiple things, I wouldn't be as great as music, at music, you know? But because I'm looking at other things, I'm learning new skills, then I don't have to, like, I grow faster in one thing because I have other skills to leverage. So if I didn't have social media skills, all my events, I would have to hire a videographer to get any kind of content, which could run anywhere from low end, like $300 to, like, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000.
So do you do all the videography yourself?
I do a lot of it.
That's amazing.
But it's not just about the videography. It's about catching those moments.
So how do you do that when you're on stage and you're performing? Because one would think that you'd be in the moment. So how are you there, like, capturing it, too?
It depends. Some, if it's an event, so there's certain events that I actually plan out, and I'll have social media teams.
Okay.
So I won't capture it. They'll capture stuff, hopefully, and I pray to God they catch the stuff that I need, that I want. Also, I shoot my own footage sometimes. So, like, I'll have camera footage up from the events.
Like, from the entire time, and then you'll go back in.
Depends.
And you'll edit what makes sense. Those viral snippets.
Right. And then sometimes people will shoot it on their own video. So, like, one, there was one that I don't know if I missed or not, but I didn't get a good angle. And then somebody in the crowd tagged me in it. So I took that video and I used that as a clip.
Okay. That's really cool. Yeah. Because, I mean, we all have really nice cameras.
Right.
Just at our fingertips. So,
right.
Like, anyone tagging you that night, you never know. They may have, like, an awesome moment.
Right.
And even if, let's say, I've had this experience before with, like, Le Cafe at certain events, where my coffee brand, where I will have people tag me either in their stories or on their reels, sharing the just, like, some really cool moments from the events.
Right.
But it's like the way it's embedded in, I don't want the entire reel. I just want, like, that moment.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I'll message them and be like, hey, can you send me that particular photo, or can you send me that little video? And people have done that, which has been great. Yeah. So going back to, like, a part that you mentioned and kind of, like, brushed over, but I would love to, like, dive a little deeper into.
Okay.
Is you mentioned that you do a lot of work with, like, different types of fighters. So can we dive into that a little bit?
Sure.
How you got into it in the beginning, first of all?
I used to fight. I had 15 pro fights. When I got done with fighting, I started just coaching and personal training.
Okay, what got you into fighting in the first place?
Initially, I wanted to be a coach, but I didn't go to college for sports. Certainly, I got a scholarship offered.
Yeah.
But I didn't have the, like, it wouldn't have worked for me. I mean, I guess it could have, but it wouldn't have really. It was in wrestling, so I got a wrestling partial scholarship offered.
Okay.
But it wasn't like a full ride scholarship. So you would essentially get a tiny amount of money that you're living off of. And so, like, I probably could have, but I think also I was just focused on doing other stuff, getting a job, trying to find a career versus essentially being a part-time wrestler.
Yeah, for sure.
So I didn't wrestle in college, but I was interested in competing and interested in coaching. And so then I found a coach that was interested in taking me on as, like, a protege for fighting, and I stuck with it and had, you know, I had 15 fights.
That's such an interesting perspective, because I think you're the first person who I've ever heard of who went into whatever their area of sport is. For you, it was fighting, wrestling specifically, or cage fighting?
Oh, I went into cage fighting, but my background was, like, wrestling and judo.
Okay. So, like, I just think it's so interesting, because normally people will go into the sport itself And then inevitably when they quote unquote either get injured or retired, that's when like maybe they become a coach. But the fact that that was your perspective all along, I think is super intriguing.
I guess so. I think I got injured before I started doing it. I was in a bad accident. And so I spent a big chunk of time just training to get better from the accident. So, I mean, that was one of the things that I guess I was unfortunate and fortunate enough to deal with, that I was able to train like nonstop and spend a large amount of time learning the science behind training.
Okay. But why coaching?
I have been coaching I immediately started coaching when I graduated high school.
Okay.
Why coaching? I like helping people out, you know, helping people on their journey, being around good people.
Right. I mean, obviously you're going to get those clients who are going to be super, maybe just like the natural talent, but also really hard workers, and you can help them progress and mm-hmm. get closer towards their dreams. But I'm sure sometimes you worked with clients who, I don't know, maybe talk the talk, but don't walk the walk. So like, what are your thoughts on that?
So I think that you let people's actions back up what they really want. And if their actions aren't backing up what they're saying, you just remind them. And if they're still not backing up what they're saying with actions, then you know that they're not serious.
Okay. Yeah.
But the other thing is that I'm not cheap. So like...
You're more higher end coach.
Right.
Right.
So like one-on-one type stuff.
And specifically for like athletes and people who are really trying to get to that goal.
I work with fitness clients too, but for athletes, like I'm as far as athlete coaches, I'm more expensive. But my specialty is with athletes is being able to take an athlete and break down what they're doing, explain it to them and fix it. Okay. So there's some athletes that I work with. But for the most part, I try to just make it like a business thing. Like I'll work with somebody a little bit here and there, but I don't invest a ton of time with them unless they're like a paid client.
Okay.
But like that's the other thing is that you don't want to do stuff, offer your services for free. And so I think just having some kind of monetary value on your service to make sure that, you know, it's not someone who's just talking and they'll waste a ton of your time.
Right.
And so, and I think for me personally is with the people that I work with, there's some people that maybe, you know, I'll just help out a little bit. But for people that are looking to work with me full time, or, you know, as an athlete or as a client, definitely there's got to be some kind of monetary involvement, because otherwise, literally, people will waste so much of your time without doing the work. What they really want is like a shrink. Like they want someone to talk to,
yeah.
But they're not serious about the work. But here's the crazy part is that you could do the work and it has the same effect as like having a shrink.
For sure.
Right.
Sometimes better.
And I'll listen to your bullshit.
Yeah, because you're like, you're being paid to be there.
Well, I mean, also I like care about people. So like people tell me stuff like I'd like to know, you know, so I think it's bullshit.
Right. I mean, also, I would imagine that like truly understanding your clients and their emotional needs, like what they're going through, it's going to affect how they show up. And so if you understand what they're going through, you could kind of dive deeper into training them.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
Also knowing like what motivates them.
Agreed.
Right.
Knowing what motivates the clients. Well, but I think just having a relationship with somebody too, beyond motivation. You know, like, I think that's super helpful keeping somebody on track.
But when you first were getting started, I mean, obviously, like, at this point, you have years of experience. You can show what you've done and, like, what people are going to get from working with you. But starting off, how do you, like, gain that credibility and still feel like your time is being valued?
I had volunteered for 5 years as a coach before I ever started charging people.
Okay.
So that would be one. Two, I spent an obsessive amount of time studying. So studying anatomy and physiology, studying supplements, studying how your body reacts to certain types of training methodologies, timelines, programming. So by the time I had started working with anybody, I had been studying this, you know, for I would say at least 7 years.
Okay. I'm actually so curious because this is a deep dive that I've been doing like personally and like been listening to a lot of topics on this conversation.
Uh-huh.
But people have been talking about how like we don't really get, a lot of people don't eat the type of diet that they need anyways to get all of the nutrients and like vitamins that they need anyways, which is why people take supplements and protein powders. But in addition to that, they were talking about how like the soil nowadays just isn't the same. It's not as nutrient dense. Therefore, even our fruits and vegetables aren't the same as like the ones our grandparents were eating.
Sure.
So what are your thoughts on that in terms of when you're like helping people game plan?
Yeah. So one, I don't try to get my vitamins from food. I try to get vitamins from a quality multivitamin.
Okay.
I try to focus food wise more on, I try to keep that basic. So if you have a multivitamin, you don't have to eat like a million different foods to get these vitamins, right? Like unless you have to, but most people don't.
Right.
So I say multivitamin, and then also look at your protein, your fat, and your carbohydrate intake. You know, look at the breakdown there. And once you have a multivitamin, it makes that stuff a lot easier because it makes that more simple. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if you're having a hard time with that, that's what my recommendation is.
There was one point in my early 20s when I was like first starting this like supplement journey, mm-hmm. where I had collected like a whole pill box that I was taking.
Right.
And I hate swallowing pills. Right. And like, especially like the fish oil ones are huge. It got to the point where like there was one morning when I actually choked on my supplements. And then I stopped taking them for a while just because like the trauma of that. But then I recently discovered like a liquid multivitamin, and that's what I take. And I just do like a little half a shot glass every morning.
When I first started taking supplements, I would buy the cheapest protein that I could find because I was broke as hell. It was like $20 for a jug of it. And it tasted, you couldn't tell between the chocolate, the vanilla, and the strawberry other than the color. Like it all tasted the same, but it tasted tastes like you were mixing flour and water. So I imagine that's what whey protein tastes like without any flavoring in it.
I mean, maybe that's what you were getting.
What? And I would try to mix it and it wouldn't mix up. And so I would just have to choke down this paste. And so every night I would gag down like 2.5-3 scoops of this protein mix. It was the most disgusting thing on the planet.
Do you remember when people were like just taking protein powder plain?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like
no water. No water. This is
a
trend that people were doing. They were taking like the scoops and just.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know about all that.
That's not a thing. That's
like had to. I could see if you had to. I don't know why you make that go to.
I will say though, I have tried so many different protein powders. I'm actually like, maybe allergic is a strong word, but I'm very sensitive to them. They break me out. Like I get acne pretty badly from them.
From protein powders.
Mm-hmm. And I've tried different types. Like I've tried like the vegan types that maybe don't have like the whey in them. Tried different brands. They all have the same effects on me.
Yeah, you just do natural protein. Like
I chicken. Do. Chicken, fish.
Fish. Beans. Kosher chicken, fish.
That's right. That's right. Yep. It's great. I'm everyone who already listens to my podcast knows that I love ChatGPT so much. I have a nickname for her. Her name's Gigi.
Okay.
And I don't know, do you utilize ChatGPT like at all?
Sure.
Okay. So a cool feature that ChatGPT has, like two of my favorite features. One is that they can create projects.
Okay.
So if you have like a certain topic, you can put it under the project and it will recreate, and you can have like themes and stuff, like instructions for how it should respond. And then also, because especially when I have my nails done, I can't type at all for the most part. So voice notes are the best. So I can like voice instruct what I want to say. I don't have to type out this whole long thing.
Right.
And it transcribes it for me.
Yeah.
It's like my favorite thing ever. But I utilize ChatGPT. I have a project called Personal Trainer, and I have a project called Weight Loss Trainer as well. And so like, for example, with the food, I'll do with Gigi, we'll go through like my pantry, my fridge, what's on my counters, what's on in my cabinets. And then I'll say, here's my budget. I want to do most of my shopping at Aldi's, and I want it to be like a Mediterranean lifestyle, but here are my weight loss goals and here's how much protein I want to have. And they create a shopping list and then also like meal prep and meal plans. Isn't that amazing?
Pretty dope.
I know.
It's ChatGPT.
Yeah, it's great. And I've utilized like also a lot of different trainers over the years, but I'm also trying to be like bougie on a budget at the moment. So I have all these screenshots from old like training programs that I've done. I put all of that into ChatGPT, let them know that I want to do functional strength training. And I mostly want to utilize like dumbbells and kettlebells. And I don't want to do any like back bearing weight, like no barbells or anything like that. And I actually want to do more freeform weights, not so much like weights using the machines. And then it creates these like amazing workouts.
Boom.
Yeah.
ChatGPT, check it out.
I could do an ad for it, honestly. I know. It's so great. But this is such like, this is just my mind like ping ponging. But going back to an earlier thing that you said with that you were a bouncer.
Uh-huh.
Are you still doing that a little bit or not really anymore?
Nope.
Okay. So question about bouncers. Was there ever any time you like really ever had to deal with any like issues really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Are you able to share any of the like?
Yeah. Like fights?
I don't know. I don't know exactly what you'd have to deal with, to be honest, because I'm not really a.
Yeah, everything.
Go out after 10 p.m. kind of girl.
Fights. One time there was like a ruckus coming from the women's room. And I didn't know what was going on, but it was like a lot of craziness, just people screaming and stuff. So I went into the women's room and people are screaming and they're like, they're having sex in there. And I looked under the stall in the women's room. The whole bathroom's packed out, right? I look down, I see two sets of feet, what clearly looked like a guy's feet and girl's feet, right? But the thing was, is like, as I was coming into the bathroom, I started seeing like a shirt go by and then pants and whatever. So this couple, they were hooking up in the bathroom in the women's room.
Yeah.
And as they were hooking up, random people started grabbing their clothes and running them through the crowd. So this couple that was banging, they basically got caught by the entire club. And then they walked out. They had to do a walk of shame at the club naked.
That's insane.
Guy was grabbing his junk, you know, walking out. The girl's doing the same thing, and they walked out the door. I don't know where they went, but they must have took off.
What a story. That's crazy. Okay. So what are they? Okay. It's so funny. I've never been into, like, nightlife.
Ever. Never?
No.
I was, like, 240 by the time I was, like, 18 or 19. It was, like, an easy job to get.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I feel like my friends go out, but they know that I don't.
Right.
So it's not that they don't. It's just more they know that if they ever hang out with me, it's like daylight hours. I'm more of the friend that you go to the art museum with.
You're like the opposite of Blade.
What's Blade?
The vampire.
Okay.
Because he only comes out at night.
I am.
Yeah.
I am because I start to get like super sleepy and out of it. Not that I go to sleep early per se. It's just that like if I'm up late, I'm up late at home, which is a totally different vibe.
Right.
Than being up late and being out.
Right.
I think my social meter dies at 9 p.m.
It's not bad.
Yeah. After that, I just can't handle people anymore.
Really? It's like I'm usually starting.
Well, it works for me because especially now that I'm going into the coffee industry and I'm working as a barista, I get up at 5.
You have to be up at 5.
And like the coffee shop I work at opens at 7.
That seems late.
It is kind of late, actually.
Like 6 is a good...
I have to be there at 6:30.
I think 6. I'm not trying to add an hour to your morning, but 6 is a good time for coffee shop.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. Because there's the early coffee goers, right?
Right.
So you're missing out on like a whole hour's worth. If we were open at 6, there would be 3 rounds of rushes in the morning instead of just 2. For sure. I feel like I'll be more motivated when it's my own coffee shop. But because I'm an employee...
Right now, 7.
Chilling. I mean, it is what it is. Although it is going to start being more of a nightlife situation for me, I guess. I'm going to have to learn how to burn both ends of the candles.
Someone manage the nightlife.
Ah. You know, I will say I'm an excellent delegator.
Yeah, as long as you find the right person.
Yeah.
Because it does take, I feel like it takes a different personality to manage like a nighttime business than a daytime business.
That's true.
Like the basic stuff would be there, but the personality, like you could be a little bit more if you're running a nightlife business than you would if you're daylight business, morning business.
Yeah, I like that. Like I could be there, but I don't have to always be there.
Right. Sense. We can't.
Like there's a difference between being there as an owner versus being there as like a manager.
I guess.
Yeah. I heard something today where I'm going to ask you the question first and then I'm going to tell you the answer that they said, which I think is my new answer.
Okay.
So the question is, and actually this is a really good one. I was thinking about you because I was trying to figure out like our episode and what we were going to talk about because there's so much to you and your story. And I was trying to like figure out what drives you. So let me start with that. Do you feel like what drives you? I mean, obviously we're all money motivated to a certain extent.
Sure.
But do you feel like what drives you in all these different areas of your life and especially where you're at right now is money or is it like personal development and like purpose? Both?
Because if you have more money, you can develop faster than someone who doesn't.
True. Right.
So you have
easier to have an abundant mindset when you have a full pocket.
Sure, sure. But also, so like just to be a musician or a comedian, you have to have sizzle reels, you have to have shows produced, you have to have like songs recorded, you have to have comedy shows recorded. So there's like a bunch of actual financial social media marketing stuff that you would have to be considered actual pro, or maybe I should say to be a successful pro.
Okay.
So like if you don't, even if you're super, super funny, but you can't get over that like basic hump of whatever that would cost you to get that done, then you're always going to be held back financially from moving forward to making more money because of the one initial thing. And so what I think like a lot of people hold back on is like having a vision, but then putting in the extra hustle time of, well, I've got to make an extra $10,000 to make this thing happen. So I'll work extra time to make that, right? I'll work overtime or two, three jobs, whatever I got to do to make that.
Right.
And so like initially, I don't think that your initial motivation should be money, because if you're jumping into something new, you're going to be waiting on this money to come. It's never going to come. So like I have things that I make money off of. And then I also have things that are like new projects, maybe that I'm starting on that don't make money. And maybe it's just a practice project, but I always, whatever I'm working on, I always try to work on it with the expectation eventually of making money. And one of my piano coaches told me this. He said it's every artist's like their first hustle, the first thing they have to make that they should accomplish is getting any kind of financial income for their art. Because once you get any kind of income, it validates your time, right? Because it just means, oh, hey, I'm good enough that someone's paying me anything at all for my art, right? And then once you get anything, you can increase the price, you can build up on price until you're a full-paid artist. But most people don't even get to the level that they're making an initial income. So like most, just for example, open mics, I see a ton of musicians come in and they just play to be open micers, but they're not playing to become like gigging musicians.
Right, like that bar we went to the other night, there'll be bands that go there and only get like $100 for the night.
Exactly. And so for a lot of musicians, which is fine if you're working up to that to get there. But it's like, I know musicians that are still playing there. They've been doing it 5-10 years and they're still playing the same, you know, low level gigs. But it's like at the beginning, you've got to be willing to make anything, and making anything is just a sign that you're to a professional level. And the simple fact that you're setting up pro gigs, it makes you a better artist, because you're like, I have to have this done and ready for people to see now. And I think like that's the saddest thing in the world, is to have art that nobody sees.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's a lot of people that whatever their holdback is personally, so like they don't want the discomfort of having their art in front of people. They don't want to deal with like assholes saying mean shit online. They don't want to deal with, you know, whatever their personal issue is, the negative things that come along with putting yourself out there. So that it's more comfortable for them just to create like quiet silence at home or wherever, instead of actually having to risk, you know, your emotions of putting your stuff out into the public,
right?
Especially when there's financial involvement.
I totally hear that. Because even with like my podcast, I started shooting back in March 2023 and I didn't release it to the public till August. Now, one of the reasons that I told people was because I wanted to create a library just in case with scheduling, to make sure that I had videos and whatnot. But the reality was, is that I was such a private person for a while there. Like I had Instagram, and then I went off of Instagram for a whole year where I wasn't even going on it as a consumer. And I really had no intention of ever going back on social media. But for my podcast, I had to, because you have to put yourself out there. And I think it was just such a scary thought, like being videoed and putting like these super intimate conversations, plus the responsibility that I felt as host with each guest, that I really wanted to make sure that who they were and their story was being shared in a way that would do them like justice. So there was like a lot of pressure that I was putting on myself.
Right.
And then also like not understanding, I'm still learning a lot, but not even understanding the concept where I was like, but what if for some crazy reason, my podcast immediately goes viral. And I thought, like, I wasn't ready for it. It was too scary for me, because right. I was such a private person at that point that level of visibility was too much for
right.
me. And then also just being scared, like, how it was received.
Right.
But, like, at this point where I'm at with my podcast, at this point, I know how much work goes into it. So even if anyone ever had anything negative to say, I'm like, you just don't understand all the work that goes into it.
Right.
You know, and like in the end of the day, people are going to have their opinions no matter what.
Right.
And also, if you think about the people who say negative opinions, I scroll on Instagram, TikTok, on YouTube all the time. I see things I don't like or agree with all the time. I don't feel the need to say anything personally or react in a negative way at all. So it's like the level of attention that someone must feel they need just to make that comment.
To make a negative comment?
Yeah.
I don't know about that. You're talking to a guy that roasts people online all the time. I don't fucking believe that shit for a second.
You don't think so?
No.
Why?
Why? I mean, I think it depends on the person. For most people, maybe it is. Maybe it's true.
Okay.
I think for me, it's just writing practice.
Right. You definitely roasted one of my guests. That one did crack me up.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, it wasn't even that big of a roast. It was just a basic question, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I get it. We'll talk about that later. That was fun.
Got it.
But no, I think it's just such an interesting progression. So the question, the initial question that I really wanted to ask you was, what's your definition of success?
I mean, like my first definition for success would have been to make an income as an artist, right? So like I'm already there on that regard. But then like I think my next definition of success would be to be make it so much that I'm not worried about, you know, second car payment or something. But like I don't know. I think it's more of like it's a financial goal for me. So I think that there's like an amount of money that I'm like, all right, if I made this, that'd be successful. But I mean then once you get there, you're always working on new stuff.
Right.
You know, so I would say it would just be, you know, as far as shows go and stuff, I feel like that's already progressing to a solid level. And I feel like I'm already doing it now and it's continuing to grow. So, I mean, I would say just more income goals probably, and then maybe more performances. Have a little bit more control over how many performances and what kind of performances I'm doing a week would be pretty dope. But yeah, I mean, I think it's going pretty good overall. Like, I feel like...
Like, you're happy with where you're at.
I'm happy with where I'm at, but I'm still working on bigger stuff.
For sure. But it's not like you're happy with the trajectory that you're on.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So I think it's just really interesting about how... So like I said, I love... Even though I'm a podcast host, I spend so much of my time listening to podcasts.
Sure.
It helps me a lot. Like, I listen to podcasts when I'm working out or at work when I'm doing mundane tasks.
Right.
Like if I'm cleaning the bathroom or if I'm like cleaning up the coffee shop or just taking care of inventory. I listen to...
All Jew podcasts.
No, I couldn't.
Only Jew stuff.
I couldn't care less.
This podcast is about menorahs.
No, I listen to podcasts a lot of times just about like entrepreneurship and personal development. So one of my all-time favorite podcasts is School of Greatness. It's with Lewis Howes.
Okay, yeah.
And first of all, I love listening to him because as a host, like he's someone whose style of interviewing is something that like I aspire to be like. And I think there's kind of two podcast hosts.
I met him when he was first getting that role.
Yeah.
So he was a former pro quarterback, right? And he had an injury. And so the injury is going to put him out for a year. And over the course of that year, he started this podcast and then just rolled into the podcast and died. Not football.
He couldn't do football anymore.
Well, maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. I mean, it took about 1 year in your prime. Sometimes for some people can be the end, but yes. So he decided not to, really, is more like it.
So how did your two paths cross?
I was at a fitness convention in California, like whenever. So I had a gym for 10 years downtown. It was awesome. I mean, I absolutely loved it. But then when downtown died, fortunately, I was seeing the trajectory of downtown, which is a very important thing to understand trajectory. So I was seeing downtown on a negative trajectory. And then at that point, I was like, I'm seeing this. I better do something about it. So I like was like, I better hammer on my piano, comedy, social media, you know, videography skills, photography skills. So I went full force on those. Right. So while I had the gym open, I would go to different seminars across the country and work with different marketing coaches, strength coaches, martial arts coaches, people from all over the nation that are or world that are just top notch. So I was like on a steady quest, you know, to work with anybody that could show me stuff to make me a better coach. So I was at a big seminar in Cali. He was there, had just finished his book, which might have been The School of Greatness. I think that is that an actual book?
It may have been his first book.
Yeah.
That's the name of his podcast.
Right. Yeah. But I think it was his first book and the name of his podcast. So he was, I think, gave everyone a free copy of the book and then had also just had maybe a few episodes in his podcast, but was just building up his podcast.
Yeah. How cool. I mean, obviously, all these people are just people at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But after a while, like when you see them after, when they're at their like most successful, they kind of like become like your heroes, right? So he's like one of my heroes.
Right.
So like if I met him, I would probably fangirl.
Yeah, it's all good.
A lot. But I really admire him because I think that there's, in my opinion, two types of podcast hosts. Maybe I'm boiling it down a little too much, but there are the ones.
Guys and girls. Boom.
No. There are the ones who love the sound of their own voice, and we love them.
Right.
Right?
I don't know about that.
Well, at least if you're part of their audience, you love them.
Okay.
They have their audience who adores them.
Okay.
Fair, right?
Okay.
And then you also have the hosts who are more like Lewis House, who interview others, and he just is like, from my perspective, is so like humble and like wanting to grow and truly understand his guests.
Right.
And so throughout listening to his podcast, I've heard bits and pieces of him. So I've learned about his story, but there really has never been a whole, I'm Lewis, this is all about me episode, you know?
Right. Which is important too.
Right. Which is important too. But I kind of like that humility. Like I really respect that. And it is interesting also to see like certain guests, I feel like bring out more of a dynamic, bubbly side of him where he's more interactive and certain ones, he just really lets them talk.
Right.
Which I think is an important quality to have as a host. You know, it's not about you. It's about your guest. Or at least that's what my hope is for my podcast.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So that's an example of one. I listened to The Higher Self by Danny Morrell. I believe that's the name of his podcast.
Yeah.
I listened to, I'm really bad at names too. I'm so bad. Her name's Haley Hoffman. And she does, I was so excited because I found her on Instagram first doing reels and stuff. She does a lot of like, they're not clips of her podcast. They're just like these inspirational, spiritual, you're amazing, like work on yourself kind of reels.
Yeah.
And then it turns out she has a podcast too, where I could just listen to her long format on these.
The same thing?
Kind of, but different. Cause it's not, I'm like, cause what I do is I take clips and I put them on, right? For her, it's just, she has an inspirational idea and she talks about it, but then her podcast is almost like the longer format.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So like, for example, we were just talking about how there's a lot of artists earlier who maybe are super incredibly talented, but they're afraid of being seen because of the potential negative backlash.
Sure. Or they're afraid of putting themselves out there, asking people for, hey, can I work with here? Can I put on a show?
So she kind of goes into that too, where she talks about the most recent episode. I've listened to it twice already. I'll probably listen to it a third time. It was such a good episode.
Sure.
It's called The Visibility Wound, where it talks about a lot of us have this fear of being seen. Like I once said in the beginning of the podcast episode, I'm a big believer that everything's energy. So there's like our conscious and our subconscious desires. So consciously, you may be saying to the world, I want to be seen as an artist, as a podcast host,
right,
as an entrepreneur. Like I want people to take me seriously. I want to make this money. I want to be doing these things. But like, have you ever noticed sometimes in your life, you set these intentions and these goals and you start taking action and then things just line up for you?
Sure.
Like it just really seems to be in alignment and flow. But then there are other times where it's like, no matter how much you want something, you just seem to be hitting a wall.
Sure.
And you just can't get there. I think that the reason why sometimes you're in alignment versus not in alignment is because, for example, a really good example is people may say, I really want to find like a romantic partner, but they've been single chronically and they just can't find the right person. They're having a really hard time with it. If you haven't really manifested something that you desire within a year, you need to check yourself and your unconscious desires, because you may say you want it, but maybe you really like your freedom and maybe you haven't had a good example of what a marriage is. So you don't really know what it is. It's just kind of like maybe it's society's external pressure saying that, oh, I want this. But then you're like, but I really like where I'm at right now. And I am afraid that maybe all these goals, ambitions, and desires that I have won't come to fruition if I have a partner, because in the past, that has been my experience, or something like that.
I would think it wouldn't take a whole year to figure out if you're on track or not.
No, not necessarily a whole year. You're right. If you're more in tune with yourself, you can check in faster. But it is an interesting thing where it's like when you have a desire for something, there could be conflicting just in subconscious things going on at the same time. So for example, with like, whether you're an artist or a podcast host, you can be like, I really want this level of success. But then at the same time, are there unconscious fears that you have around success, right? That are stopping you?
Maybe, but I think more so than the unconscious fears around success, it's people are afraid to invest in the work.
Like consistent, boring, disciplined work.
Like when it's time to talk about doing something, like, hey, let's start a company, let's do this. That's the great part. Passionate. Everyone's easy. That's
You're fun. So right.
But then it's like, hey, now we have to meet every week, every single week for the next like year. We have to make this work happen as a workload. Then all of a sudden they're like, whoa, 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 whoa. So just a joke, like not a joke, but as a great example, I got a buddy that I would go out every single weekend to go to bars, go hang out, grab some beers, have a good time, right? Never, ever an issue. But the second I asked him to start working on a business, like, hey, once a week, let's meet for an hour, right? Not like 4 or 5 hours like we do, where we do absolutely nothing. Let's meet for 1 hour, but let's get 1 hour of work in. And then over time, we'll have this thing done. Then it's like all of a sudden his time's valuable and he doesn't have time to spend and all, you know, because it's not just the time. It's the investment of work, right? So people don't want to invest the work until they know for sure that they're going to get a financial return, which as we just talked about, you can't be focused on the financial return off the gate. But if you just focus on doing the pro work, the financial return will come.
Right. And there's levels to it. There's so many ways about success. Like, for example, for me, my dream that's fun to talk to anyone about is my coffee shop, right?
Right.
And it's like funny because if you go on Instagram or TikTok, all the girlies are out there being like, I wish I could quit my 9-to-5 and just open up a cute little coffee shop that sells right. flowers and all these things.
Right.
And like, as someone who is actually putting in the work to make that a reality, I find those so frustrating because it makes it seem like the work that I'm doing is just like this cute, fluffy pink job, if you will, when it's like real work. And it takes a lot to make it a reality.
It does.
Thanks for that. I appreciate that. No, it's actually funny you say that because the other thing is there is a lot of work that goes into starting a business, even if it's a little coffee shop.
Sure.
But at the same time, like I was thinking from the perspective, I'm a hard worker and I'm super ambitious, but I know that that could be super intimidating to men. So I'm like, it can be. So I was like, what job can I do that's fulfilling to me and I can like have that fulfillment from my ambition and my hard work while still doing things that I enjoy, right? But won't come off as intimidating. Because if I say that like, oh, I run a coffee shop, it doesn't sound as intimidating as if I say, oh, like I'm the general surgeon for a hospital or I'm this like corporate lawyer.
I guess so. I think the things that would sound intimidating about a corporate lawyer would be a personality trait that you would need to be a corporate lawyer.
Right.
So that would be the intimidating thing. Not because someone's an actual corporate lawyer, it's because they would expect a personality that would be like, ah, my.
No, 100%, but that's what I'm saying.
Would it be like someone's just like, bullshit, that's not coffee, and they argue with everything.
But that is very much how my personality used to be. I wanted to be a lawyer.
You could have been.
I could have been.
But that's too intimidating.
Correct.
Now you're going to be a barista.
I am currently a barista, but I will say like for me, part of what I wanted to do is I wanted to get that experience without the responsibility of owning a coffee shop first, because it's almost like, if you will, it's like CEO undercover, where it's like, I'm not a CEO. Well, I guess I technically am because I am already starting my coffee business online and I'm already trying to do sales. I'm already out there doing farmers markets and doing events. But working for someone else means that A, I can learn from their mistakes. I've also had the privilege of working a shift with the owner of the coffee shop.
Right.
And like my first previous introverted self who had a lot of anxiety and was a little scared of cat. The first time I heard I was working with him on a shift, I was like, oh God, I'm so nervous. Like, working with the boss is so intimidating because I'm like, how am I going to perform? Like, what's he going to think? All these things, right? But then I was like, okay, let's do a reframe. Love a good reframe. When else am I going to have 8 hours of uninterrupted time with the owner of a coffee shop? Right. I'm working with him for 8 hours straight. Let me ask him all my questions and learn from him and see how he operates, you know? Mm-hmm. It was really cool. I learned so much that day and was so invaluable to me. And so, like, from an outside perspective, here I am making, like, minimum wage, but, like, the value of what I'm learning is so invaluable, if that makes sense. Because I was going to have to learn it eventually anyways. Let me just dive in and learn it now. And my perspective was, if I could, like, dial back my spending habits and live as simply as possible and live how maybe most wouldn't want to live at 29, then maybe one day I could live how most can't. Mm-hmm. It's the dream, right? Putting in the work now, so maybe to see more later. So the other thing is that I also know that you learn a lot from your coworkers. It doesn't really matter what business it is, whether it's like a business or a corporation or anything like that. I've noted, because I've worked corporate for 8 years, and I've seen how, like, a lot of times the people in the bottom level are the smartest people. They're the hardest workers. They understand the business, but, like, the higher ups don't really listen. And sometimes that could be to their detriment.
Sometimes.
If they wouldn't just hear, like, the good opinions and, like, what they're seeing, like, it could 10X their business. But a lot of times egos get in the way because maybe they don't feel like they deserve to be in the role they're in too. They have their own insecurities. And that's why I think being a founder or a CEO or a manager or anything, any executive level position, if you can be in a place where you're humble enough to be like, yes, I'm in a position of leadership and there's a reason why I'm here and why I'm hired in this. But I also have all these people underneath me who are experts in their niche field. And if I could just, like, get over my own ego and listen to them, there's so much I could gain from this, you know?
I got called in once to work with my boss.
Yeah.
Worked at O'Charlie's, one of my first jobs. I was a cook, you know? Yeah. There's this guy there, his name was Chris Maldonado, right? And he was kind of an odd bird, right? He'd be like, hey, young guys, we're done. Here's what we gotta do, right? And he was known for trying to lure the hostesses. He'd be like, hey, can you go grab this out of the walk-in? And then they'd go in the walk-in to grab something. And he would walk in behind them and trap them in the walk-in, right? Try to make out with them. So, this is during a time where I'm bouncing. So he tells me, he's Jeremy, I need you to come in 8 a.m. tomorrow, right? And I was like, 8 a.m., I'm bouncing. I've been working like 3:30. And he goes, I just need to do it this one time. I got to show you how to do it. I was like, okay. So I show up, I'm like tired, 8 a.m. And I'm like chopping up vegetables for the day, okay? So Chris comes in. And he goes, Jeremy, you gotta do it faster, right? And he's all coked out. And he goes, here's what you gotta do. You gotta move the mic, hold your hand like this. He goes, you're chopping. You keep it going. He goes, your knife's hard. You'll never miss. And he misses his hand and goes right into the back of his hand with the knife. And he pulls it out and he wraps his hand in a towel. And he goes, all right, keep going. And they took off, right? Because there's no way he's taking a drug test. He's coked out of his mind.
God.
That's my, that wasn't like an Aesop's fable. There's nothing no moral story behind that. That's just my story about working with the boss.
But that's an example of, like, just because someone's in a position of leadership doesn't necessarily mean you respect them.
You don't have to respect them, and it doesn't mean they're not going to shove a knife in the back of their hand. Remember that.
But I think from my perspective was I want to be a leader, not a boss.
Okay.
Right? Like, I want to really create an environment where, like, my team, first of all, feels like they're in a safe enough environment, like, emotionally, that they could, like, be their best version of themselves when they're not working under anxiety. And then B, also that they feel comfortable talking to me when they see ways that I can make the business better.
Sure.
Okay. So, like, for example, working as a barista now, I'm not a manager. So all the baristas feel really comfortable telling me all the things that they would do different and what they like and don't like. And I have learned so much about what I will and will do just from that experience alone as well.
Right.
You know? So to me, it's been invaluable.
I would imagine. I mean, I think anytime you can work in the field that you're trying to be an expert in before you actually delve full into the field, I think that's invaluable.
I wanted to see if I really wanted to do it. Is this just for, to your point earlier? It's like, is this just something that's fun to talk about? Or is this something that I really love? Because the reality is, no matter what you love, there's going to be points where it's going to stop, you know? And to every job, no matter how much you love it, there's parts of it that are just work.
Right.
And I would say being a barista has actually helped my people skills even more, because there's like no loss. Like, I just talk to people all day, every day. I meet all kinds of people. And so I use it as this huge social experiment where I'm like, I have probably 1 to 3 minutes with each person. How can I get the most out of this experience? Sometimes I just get their coffee order, but sometimes I really like try to like have meaningful conversations. And I've gotten some podcast guests, actually, and made friends from that.
1 to 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Speed dating.
They say you can predict with like 85% accuracy whether or not you would enjoy hanging out with someone in just 5 minutes of hanging out with them. So like, you hang out with someone for 5 minutes and they're like, hey, you like that guy, you want to be friends? You could accurately predict like 85% of the time. I think too, if you surround yourself with people that, you know, they're not pushing you forward, I think that's important too. Important to be around people that are helping you move forward.
I heard this recently. It was, you've got two types of friends. The remember when friends and the imagine if friends. And both are important in their own way. You have to be careful with the remember when friends, but the imagine if friends are great because they meet you where you're at and they really talk about the future.
Imagine if friends.
Imagine if, like, those are your friends who are like pushing you in your career goals. Those are the friends who are like, let's like look at this vision. How can we get here? It's like that friend that you had where you're like, hey, we have this business idea. Let's sit down every week and make it a reality. Like, here are the steps. Like, let's work towards it. So not just talk.
Yeah, that's not, but that doesn't happen too often. So I think
it depends.
For me, it doesn't happen too often. And I've tried to, you know, I've done different projects with some people where it has happened, and a lot of projects with people that they're just dreamers.
Yeah.
So I mean, just because they're imagining with you doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to put in the work.
It's hard because going back to our original conversation with like fitness and health, let's say, for a long time, I talked about like wanting it, doing the research, having the coaches, having like, you know.
Right.
But it's like, was I doing all the work that I need to do? Because in the beginning, there's like the beginner curve, right? There's learning about nutrition. There's learning about working out. There's learning about what you need to do to take care of yourself and getting rid of bad habits. But then there's actually just doing the work.
Right.
And doing it consistently when it's not fun and it doesn't. You know.
I'm making a book.
Are you?
I just finished writing it, but I mean, it's got a lot. I'm not finished. I finished the first draft. It's called 30 Day Transformation. It'll be available on my website, and I'll send you a copy when I get done.
That's great.
And it takes a lot of guesswork out of the whole learning stuff, and it puts it in actionable steps so that each day it's giving you a new thing to work on, that by the end of the 30 days, you'll have all these different action steps in place that are just daily habits that you should make part of your daily routine.
Yeah, that's great. I feel like I know what mine are. I'm just doing them now. For me, Kilimanjaro was like a big wake-up call. I feel like I might have brushed on this when we met a few nights ago.
You talked briefly.
So like in America, specifically, there's like this big movement for like body positivity.
Right.
Especially with women. Like all bodies are bikini bodies and that kind of thing.
Okay.
Right? Which sounds nice on the surface. But when I actually went on this trip to climb the world's largest freestanding mountain, and I did it, and I did summit all three, but I did summit the first summit. But even so, like the other parts where I was just like hiking, it was so physically challenging for me, even more than the rest of my group. Summit night's different. Summit's hard for everyone, but for sure, for most people anyways, but for sure the beginning part of the hike, like my speed, my endurance, how hard it was for me, it could have been easier.
Right.
And that was because of choices I had made months and years prior.
Right.
And like that was the first time where like I really had to face that, versus like in America, you can kind of avoid it. That right. makes sense. Because we don't have necessarily the physically of an active life. If you choose to go to the gym, if you choose to run or
nobody will say anything.
Right. Right. And that's the other thing. And sometimes there's almost the opposite, where it's almost like you first start a diet or you first start a health regimen and everyone's like supportive and behind you. But then the first time that it doesn't align with like your family and friends, then they're the first someone sometimes to pull you down.
Yeah, they'll keep you from, you know, establishing good habits. But I think also it depends on what you do, because I think it's a lot. What the easy thing to do is to meet with people that are, oh, hey, let's go out to eat. But it's harder to be like, hey, let's go walk at the park. Hey, let's go play basketball. Hey, let's go hit the gym. So I mean, I think part of our social structure is simply bad habits of activities.
Good way to phrase it. But you know what? If I have enough discipline that my friends know, let's say that I'm not the girl who's going to go out to the club with them, but would go to the art museum with them.
Right.
I could do the same thing with other things. So it's already something I have in me. I just need to like apply it. Thank you for that. That was well said. But anyways, on this mountain, it was like the first time where body positivity, I felt like it was a crock of bullshit.
Sure.
Like for real, for real. Like no more just like niceness about it, where it's just like, in the end of the day, everyone can have their own opinions on like physical beauty in terms of how skinny, curvy, whatever, whatever. Your opinion's your opinion, like your preference is your preference. But in terms of like feeling good in your body, having the energy to do the things you want to do and not feeling like you're trapped in your own body, or dressing according to your style versus your body shape, you know, like those are things you can't argue about.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of soft people in society that think that they're going to walk on eggshells versus just be real about having conversations. I mean, I know I need to lose weight. You know, it's like I need to step up training. I'm battling with like a paralyzed arm and battling through that. But I mean, still, I try to stay on top of it. And so I'm steadily getting back into where I need to be. But I mean, I think that's something that everybody battles with. So whether or not you're doing something about it is more important. And whether or not you're surrounding yourself with people that will put you on the right track.
Right.
You know, so I mean, it's like I've got friends that invite me out to do like boxing, kickboxing, to go run, to go hit the stairs at the art museum, to go rock climbing. Like that's a regular thing. And so just me having that, you know, my overall fitness is going to be better than most people just from that little stuff alone that a lot of people don't have.
But I think the other thing that I think for me is very important also is nutrition.
Sure.
Because you cannot run your food.
Yeah, I mean, if you're overweight, you're trying to lose weight, you're not going to be able to do it eating shitty foods.
For example, working at, I'm not going to say the name of the coffee shop, but the coffee shop that I work at, as you know, has amazing baked goods, which easy access for me. And there were times when I was like super disciplined, but there were times where like, oh, I want a little sweet treat. And like maybe once a day I'd have my little special sweet treat. There was a huge rush, work was stressful. Maybe I was working with a coworker who was annoying me, sweet treat. But now I've been proactively planning and bringing lunch and bringing healthy snacks and bringing foods that will just like, I can eat. Because if I don't bring anything and that's all I have to eat, that's what I'm gonna eat.
Right. I was a pretty all-time social person until I started doing piano stuff. When I started doing piano stuff, I felt more comfortable just being by myself.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. Just something split in my head. I don't know why. I think I'm just geared towards being social, but I think something like doing piano, something like that. But you know what? No, I take that back. Because when I was doing martial arts stuff, also, I spent a lot of time by myself. Because here's why, I think. There's when you're doing something that's like high level, you have to put in more work than the average person. So like if I stayed on your piano plan or your martial arts plan, I would never be that great at either one of them, right? Because you don't do either one, right? But even if I followed someone else who's like doing an average plan, you know, which most people, there's lots of piano guys or martial artists do average plans. That'd be, you could find those, you can find people and you can get some level of development from working with them. But it's like the level to go full pro, like you have to put in so much more work and time. You have to be willing to be by yourself. And I think with martial arts, it was easier to be by myself because I could just turn on music and whatever physical task, whether it's lifting, training, speed work, whatever I was doing, I could just listen to music and tune out my like own head. I feel like when I'm playing piano, it feels a little bit different for some reason. I feel more alone than I do when I'm like training alone.
Interesting. I mean, it requires a certain level of focus.
Maybe. You know? That might be it. But so does the other stuff. But it feels like I'm committing to being alone more so for some reason than like running does.
That is interesting. You know what's funny?
What's funny?
Speaking of funny, I feel like when I first met you and I heard that you were a comedian, I was like, oh, this is so cool. I've never had a comedian on my podcast. And I feel like we've like barely touched on any of the comedian stuff.
Right.
Right.
Well, you asked me about other stuff.
That's true. You know what's interesting? I mean, I think to me what was interesting, like as I was talking to you more about like your perspective on comedy, also the first conversation, me trying to create relatability, the first thing I thought of was like the Mrs. Maisel TV series.
Right.
And you were like, absolutely not. Like,
I don't know. I didn't hate it. I just hated the one thing about it. I liked the show. I've watched part of the show. I'm probably going to finish the show. I liked the show.
Okay.
I just hated that one thing. I didn't hate the show. I just hated one thing about the show, which is she rolled in a comedy.
Yeah.
Way too damn easy. And listen, I know I piss a lot of people off because I rolled in a comedy way too damn easy. And even my ass doing it, it took three and a half years to where I was making like pro-level pay on shows.
Right.
Okay. That gal rolled in like week one, bam, killing it, headlining.
Right, but it was also a TV show, right?
I know, but that's the one thing I didn't like. But look, here's the other thing, and this is just my opinion on storytelling in general, is social media thing. I think when you're telling a story, to tell the story where you just like come in and you're kicking ass all the time isn't as great of a story. And so they showed the struggle in her personal life where she's struggling with the relationship, her husband cheating on her, trying to keep it together, whatever ends up happening. I'm not all the way through, don't end it for me.
Okay.
But so they show the struggle there, but they don't show the struggle of actually having to go into a set and bombing and looking like fucking loser on stage.
Do that eventually.
Eventually later on. Mm-hmm. But that's what I'm saying. That's what I didn't like, is that would happen out the gate and then later it'll still happen, but it becomes less often.
Right. But I think for her story, I think part of it, at least the way that they portrayed it, you're right. She was almost accidentally successful. It was like she was naturally funny and like she kind of killed it on these like small
shows
that she was doing
right. Yeah.
Which, like, as you were explaining to me, is not usually the case, right?
Right.
Like, usually,
because here's what people don't get.
Right.
The small shows are harder because you have to be that much funnier because there's all this dumb shit going on. There's bar going on. There's cocktail servers. There's people cracking jokes in the crowd, mm-hmm. talking to each other. So those are the hard shows. When you actually have a 200-300 person attentive audience, that's easier if you're skilled. Okay. The bar where you've got to, like, get someone's attention away from the sports game they're watching and get them to laugh at your jokes, that's the challenge.
Right. Especially if the lineup before you wasn't that funny and people right. already are not.
Like tuned out. They're like, fuck, just end of the shit, please.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and you're not known yet. Like, whatever. Like,
right.
People, you don't have that, what's it called? Rapport with the audience.
Right.
But for her, I think it was just kind of like the way they portrayed it was that she was presenting something that was unexpected, right? This very like beautiful, put together housewife of like late 50s, early 60s.
Right.
So for her to be coming out and being as crass and open as she was, especially during that time
period,
was so much more shocking / hilarious because, again, like, at least for me, one of the things that I love about comedians and like humor, at least the kind that I appreciate, is when people have like observational humor. When people can take an experience that is so relatable and break it down in a way that's so funny to me.
Right.
Where you're like, wait a minute, that's so relatable. And yet it's so stupid and it is so funny. And we like, yes, let's laugh about it. I would so much rather laugh than cry about it when you can do it in that way. Cause I think there's also like a lot of like almost pain points. I remember, for example, there was a clip, Ellen DeGeneres, before she became who she is now.
A monster.
Right? When she was just like a startup comedian, she was so funny. Like,
she's funny.
She was relatably, like, hysterically funny. I still remember, like, I'm not going to portray it in the funniest way because I'm not a comedian. But I remember, like, she was talking about this moment where we're all on the plane and, like, all of a sudden, like, the stewardess, the flight attendant becomes the most important person. And she walks by and we're just so thrilled and excited to get our tiny little snack bag of peanuts and crackers. And there's like probably like three peanuts in the entire bag. This was back when they had peanuts on planes before the allergies. You notice they don't serve them anymore.
I didn't notice.
Yeah. And so like, she's like, you tear it open and then there's some sort of turbulence. And then your peanut goes like flying and you're like picking it up from everyone. I'm so sorry. I just have three. And I remember when she said that, I just died. I just died laughing the first time I heard it. It was so funny.
Yeah.
I love that shit. So like that kind of observational humor is phenomenal. And so for her doing that was great. But again, when she started to rise and was trying to like compete against like the big headliners, right? And then there was more of an expectation for her in the big show. So at least that's how they portrayed it there. That was when She had to learn strategy. She had to learn how to plan. She had to learn how to write those jokes and plan the jokes and like figure out her audience and what would make them laugh, right? And then there was like certain mistakes that she made and like,
sure.
And also depending on how she came, like there's a fine line between having this like sarcastic humor that people appreciate versus being obnoxious.
Right.
And it's such a fine line.
Yeah.
And sometimes
it's different for everybody.
Correct. Like sometimes there could be one crowd and you're absolutely killing it. You're doing the same exact energy, the same exact lines as another crowd. And they think you're the most offensive person ever.
True.
So I think they, in my opinion, I think, like you said, I think there was like nuances and maybe the way it is now, but I think there was a certain insight into the comedian world that maybe people aren't aware of was kind of intriguing.
For her?
Yeah. And for me too. Like,
or from the Miss Maisel.
For Mrs. Maisel. And like, okay. I'm just thinking too, like, I know a lot of lawyers who can't watch law shows, or I know a lot of doctors who can't watch any like doctor shows just because like they look at it and they're like, this is not how it is. This is not real. You know, like an emergency room would never look like this.
No, I like the show. I just didn't like that one part. It wasn't like I'm a comedian. Shit. I just didn't like the fact that they didn't portray how much harder it is to get it going.
It is hard to get it going, but I also think like it is intriguing and also about how like, especially the time period that we live right now.
Right.
Like you were explaining to me how when you're business minded, you can't just be a comedian, you can't just be like a funny guy. It's also just about like being business minded and then also having like the video production skills and the social media skills and the networking and marketing skills to get yourself out there. But if
networking skills are the least important.
But never was there a time, I think, where it would be easier to make it. Because of everything. Really?
Because like back in the 80s, 90s, you could literally just go around and tell people you're a comedian. You didn't have to be a comedian. You just literally could lie and they wouldn't, how would they check? How would they check you? There's no internet. There's nothing.
Okay.
I mean, there is, I think, what, but there's not. It's not like it's an established list like it is now, you know?
Okay. So you're saying it's harder to get in now?
Well, there's more competition. Yeah, there's way more competition now. Mm-hmm. That was like the golden age of comedy where if you were a comedian at all, you're working nonstop. Now, there's every weekend are, there's three main arenas, right? So three main comedy clubs. There's Funny Bone, Westport Funny Bone, St. Charles, and Helium Comedy Club. Those three. Okay. There's 260 comics. Each club has two spots, which means there's a total of six jobs per weekend in St. Louis, which means every weekend there's 254 comedians that are out of work.
Wow.
Which means that if you can't create your own jobs, your own shows, you are going to be out of work. You're never going to make an income because that's not how you're going to make an income.
Mm-hmm.
So no, now even with all the social media stuff, it's a lot. There's a lot more competition, but if you're savvy on marketing, social media, and sales, as well as you have a world-class act of whatever comedy, music, whatever it is you're doing, if you have all of that, then you're at least almost guaranteed that you're going to be a success, but only if you have all those things. Like you'd be a world-class musician, not have those other skills, and you're not going to necessarily make anything happen. It's about the same as a lottery ticket. So, I mean, I think they, with the technology available now, if you're willing to do the work, that you can still make it happen for you. I think that's a better way to say it. But I think as far as like it being easy to do it, I think it was way easier back in the day than it is now. Because you literally, now at least, you know, most comedy clubs, for you to work up to a headliner position at most clubs, you either have to be someone who's already established or you have to be somebody that is in-house, like you work your way up through the clubs. So like, don't take somebody out of town if they're established, if they can sell.
But I will argue at one point.
Okay.
Which is that, especially on TikTok, if you can become like viral on TikTok, that can help skyrocket your career way more.
Yes, but here's the problem, right? To an extent. So if you're willing, if you are successful, but the problem with what you're saying is to be a TikTok star, you have to be a regular show producer. Most people aren't going to go viral off of like one video. So it's like they build up videos and then they have a viral sensation video,
Exactly. But
they also had to do a large amount of work at the very beginning to
get up.
So there's a lot of work that goes into the video production, writing, you know, however you do your videos. So there's that. But then, on the other thing is that even if you do that and you blow up, and let's say you get like 1 million followers, is a good number for being famous. So you got 1 million followers online just because you do that. That doesn't mean you're necessarily going to sell out shows, but even if you sell out shows, it doesn't mean you're necessarily ready to produce an actual show.
Because I forgot who it was, but there was a comedian who was really funny on his shorts.
Right.
And because of that, he ended up getting like this really big, maybe it was even a Netflix special, I want to say.
Sure.
And then I remember seeing the reviews for the Netflix special,
right,
where people were like, he just didn't show up at this show, funny-wise, the same way.
It wasn't the shorts.
Correct.
It really is different format, so he wasn't skilled in that format yet.
Correct. But but people are not forgiving, right?
Yeah.
So, like,
he's just got to work on it. He'll have to put years. Yeah, to do another special, that guy's probably going to have to put, like, 2-3 years of work in, but everyone forgets about it, and then put another one out.
And people have a short memory. That is the one nice thing about nowadays.
They're not going to remember 2-3 years from now.
We all have squirrel memories nowadays.
So, I mean, also, if you've got that ability to create shorts and create fans, even if your special sucks, you'd still make some money because people would buy it.
That's true.
But I'm not saying do that. I'm just saying when you come out again with your next special, you can still sell that. You'd probably sell that also.
Would that ever be a goal for you to have a Netflix special?
Not necessarily, but I wouldn't be against it. But no, not really. It's not a goal, but it's something I'm working on technically. So I guess it's not on my event planner. I'm writing jokes. I'm writing new material all the time. I'm performing material all the time. Perform live shows on a regular basis. Netflix specifically hasn't been a goal for mine, but I wouldn't, I'm not against it. But what makes more sense to me than a Netflix special would be like, I would be interested in producing a either free or a sellable special. So like that would make sense. So producing a special would not necessarily work with Netflix.
Got it.
So I think the Netflix thing is just something I haven't considered, not that I can't, but the other thing is on my to-do list of produced art, the next thing I need produced right now is just record 5 songs.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the actual having a comedy special is high up on my art of needs. So the next thing I'm doing, which I've got loosely planned right now, I got 5 songs to record. Once I get those songs, I'll automatically be like a national touring act. Which would be cool. And so like as far as a special goes, I will definitely record a special eventually. But the thing with the special is let's say you've got 45 minutes of material. You need to have more time than that to release the special. Because if you just put out a special, people see the special, they come see you live, then all they're gonna see is the same jokes they saw in the special.
Mm-hmm.
If you put out a special and you've got new jokes, then you got like a fan for life.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And you don't want to do that to people either. You don't want to put out something online and they'll be doing the exact same jokes in person.
Yeah, 100%. Because people also love to see fresh material.
So that's the magic special rule is whatever special time you have, you need at least 50% of that special time passed. So if you got a 30-minute special, you need 45 minutes of gold material to put the special out. So you got 15 to work off of.
Yep. Okay. I hear it now. I think that was what was intriguing too, like with comedy, how it's not just like you get up there and you be funny. You know, like there's so much to it. There's a lot to it.
A lot of practice, a lot of live practice, performance, a lot of writing practice. And if you're, there's some joke, it's like this guy goes up to a comic. He says, hey kid, I saw you on stage. You're real funny. And he goes, well, how long do you think it's going to take me to, get the top? And he's like, hey, your level is going to be like 8 years. Do you write? The guy's like, no, I don't write. He says, okay, see you in 15 years.
Oof.
So like, it's something you could do. Like you could not write, not be a writer, but the people that do, it takes them so much longer. And there's a few exceptions to every rule, but.
Listen, I mean, going back to my Kilimanjaro trip, same thing. Like technically anyone could do it. It's just, what's your experience going to be like? How fast are you going to get there? Right?
Sure.
The more prepared you are, the better your experience is going to be, the faster you'll get there.
But not everyone's going to.
Not everyone's going to get there. Yeah. Okay. We've covered so many different topics tonight. Is there anything that you're like really wanting to talk about that we haven't mentioned yet?
Check out Gateway Dueling Pianos. We're going to be at Eckert's August 16th. We got ticketed shows coming up. We got a bunch of badass shows. We're playing at the Four Seasons. We're playing at Ritz-Carlton. Follow us on Facebook, Gateway Dueling Pianos. Don't follow me on Facebook if you're easily offended. That's it.
We'll share all the links as well so that my audience could support you.
Okay. Don't follow me if you're easily offended.
And then, yeah, this has been great. I want to end with my tradition that I have. So the whole basis of this podcast episode, well, episodes, my whole podcast series, is this Hebrew quote, which is Ezef Chacham Halomi Mikol Adam, which means one who is wise is one who learns from everyone. So we've learned a lot from you. But if you can leave us with like one last favorite quote or life lesson.
Don't fear change, embrace it.
Oh, I love that. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
This was great. Well, guys, this is another amazing episode. And like I said, we're going to have all the links so that you can go follow Jeremy. And with this episode, if you enjoyed it, please go share it with a friend. If you're not already watching and you want to watch the video you can find it on Spotify and YouTube. And if you're on YouTube, give this a thumbs up and go subscribe on YouTube, because if you're not already subscribed to me, what are you doing with your life? And we'll see you guys next week. I hope you have a great week. Let's get it. Let's go.
Nachama. Hit the subscribe button. Peace.